From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is sending a terrible message across Milwaukee and across the country that ICE officials and FBI could just show up to a court and, using an administrative warrant, attempt to disrupt due process. The message that this is sending to immigrants on any sort of visa status is terrible.
The Trump administration escalates attacks on judges and immigrants. On Friday, FBI agents arrested Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan on charges of obstructing justice and concealing an immigrant from arrest as federal agents waited in the courthouse hallway. We'll speak with two people who know the judge well. But first, three U.S. citizen children were deported Friday, including a four-year-old boy with fourth-stage cancer who was actively receiving treatment here, but was deported with his mother and seven-year-old sister. Another two-year-old was deported with her mother. We'll get the latest. Then Martin O'Malley, former head of the Social Security Administration, has issued a dire warning that Social Security could collapse due to sweeping Trump cuts.
Elon Musk, keep your hands off of Social Security.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 68 African migrants have been killed in a U.S. airstrike in Yemen. Houthi media outlets report the U.S. bombed a detention center in the western province of Sada. Another 47 migrants were injured in the attack. A separate U.S. attack killed at least 8 people in the capital, Sana'a. The Pentagon says it's carried out 800 strikes on Yemen since March 15th, after Houthi fighters vowed to resume targeting ships in the Red Sea in an attempt to pressure Israel to end its war and blockade on Gaza. In Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed 23 Palestinians so far today, after Israel forces killed at least 53 people Sunday, including 6 who were killed when Israel bombed a cafe near the Nuseirat and Burej refugee camps. Meanwhile, the World Food Program's announced it's run out of food to distribute in Gaza due to Israel's two-month-long blockade. Earlier today, the International Court of Justice began a 5-day hearing on Israel's obligations to provide aid to Gaza. Palestinian envoy Amar Hijazi accused Israel of using humanitarian aid as weapons of war.
That's really the heart of why Palestine and over 40 other states are addressing the court today. It is not about the number of aid trucks Israel is or is not allowing into the occupied Palestinian territory, especially Gaza. It is not about Israel destroying the it is about Israel destroying the fundamentals of life in Palestine while it blocks UN and other humanitarians from providing life-saving aid to the population. It is about Israel unraveling fundamental principles of international law, including their obligations under the UN Charter. It is about Israel turning Palestine, and particularly Gaza, into a mass grave for Palestinians and those coming to their aid.
On Sunday, Israeli fighter jets bombed Beirut's southern suburbs again. The UN and Lebanese officials condemned the strike, with Lebanon's president warning Israel's actions are undermining stability in the region. In Canada, police have charged a man with murder for the car ramming death of 11 people during a music festival in Vancouver Saturday evening. It took place during the annual Lapu-Lapu festivities, which celebrate the Filipino community and culture. The victims ranged in age from 5 to 65. Dozens were wounded. This is a local community member.
It's kind of like you can be strong and weak at the same time. And you know, the efforts with gathering with not just the Filipino community, but everybody. And if you've been to a Filipino event or organizer, there is a saying called Isang Baksak. And it means when one falls, we all fall. But again, when one rises, we all rise.
No motive for the mass killing has been identified, but authorities say the suspect, 30-year-old Kaiji Adam Lowe, has a history of mental health-related interactions with Vancouver police. The tragedy came just 2 days ahead of high-stakes snap elections in Canada. Voters today will decide between the ruling Liberal Party, now led by Justin Trudeau's successor, Prime Minister Mark Carney, and Pierre Poilievre, who leads the Conservatives. He had been leading in the polls when Trudeau stepped down in January, but Carney's defiant response to Trump's tariffs and his threats to annex Canada have helped propel the Liberals' chances of staying in power. On Saturday, hundreds of thousands of mourners gathered at the Vatican for the funeral of Pope Francis, who died last week at the age of 88. During the eulogy, Cardinal Giovanni Battista remembered Pope Francis as a pope of the people and a peacemaker.
Di fronte all'infuriare di tante guerre di questi anni,
faced with the raging wars of recent years, with their inhuman horrors and countless deaths and destruction, Pope Francis insistently raised his voice, imploring peace and calling for reason and honest negotiation to find possible solutions. War, he said, is only the death of people and the destruction of homes, hospitals, and schools.
More than 50 world leaders attended the Pope's funeral, including President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two met at the Vatican prior to the funeral. The meeting came a day after Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. On Sunday, Trump expressed disappointment with Putin for continuing to attack Ukraine while refusing to agree to a U.S. broker deal to end the war in Ukraine. Earlier today, Putin announced a unilateral 3-day ceasefire in Ukraine beginning May 8th. On Sunday, Russia fired nearly 150 drones at Ukraine, killing at least 4 people. Meanwhile, North Korea's confirmed for the first time it had sent combat troops to fight alongside Russian forces. The Trump administration's escalating its attack on judges. On Friday, FBI agents arrested a county judge in Milwaukee, Hannah Dugan, who was charged with obstruction and concealing an individual from arrest. The FBI accused her of allegedly helping an undocumented immigrant avoid arrest inside a Wisconsin courthouse. The judge's arrest was widely criticized. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin said, quote, "This action fits into the deeply concerning pattern of this president's lawless behavior and undermining courts and Congress's checks on his power," unquote. The FBI director, Kash Patel, is facing accusations he broke DOJ policy by posting a photo online of Judge Dugan in handcuffs. On Saturday, protesters rallied in Milwaukee to protest the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants and the arrest of Judge Dugan.
We are out here today with a message for the FBI, for the DOJ, for President Trump himself. And that message is, drop the charges, stop the raids, stop the deportations. We are also out here with a message for Judge Hannah Dugan. And that message is, we have your back.
In related news, federal agents in New Mexico have arrested a former judge, Jose Luis Cano, and his wife. They've been accused of tampering with evidence linked to a former tenant who the government claims is a member of a Venezuelan gang. In other immigration news, the Trump administration's deported to Honduras 3 U.S. citizen children, including a 4-year-old boy who's actively receiving treatment for a rare form of stage 4 cancer. The boy was removed with a 7-year-old sister who's also a U.S. citizen and their mother. In a separate case, the U.S. deported a 2-year-old U.S. citizen with her mother. In that case, U.S. District Judge Terry Dowdy said the girl was sent away, quote, with no meaningful process. The judge was Trump appointed. Meanwhile, ICE has conducted a number of high-profile immigration raids. In Florida, ICE worked with local officials to detain nearly 800 people. Meanwhile, in Colorado Springs, ICE agents raided a nightclub and made over 100 arrests this weekend. In other immigration news, protesters rallied outside the Charles Schulz Airport in Santa Rosa, California, Saturday to protest Avalo Airlines, which recently signed a deal to work with ICE on deportation flights. In a major reversal, the Trump administration's restored the ability of thousands of international students to study in the United States, at least for now. The Trump administration had been sued at least 65 times for terminating the status of students in a database called SEVIS, the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System. It's unclear how many students may have already left the country after the government changed their status. ABC reports some of the targeted students had supported pro-Palestine protests, but many had not. At least 46 people have died after a massive explosion at one of Iran's main ports Saturday. The blast injured over 1,000 people. Iranian authorities have not said yet what caused the blast. In January, the Financial Times reports ships carrying missile fuel were headed to the port from China. The blast occurred as the U.S. and Iran were holding a third round of talks over Iran's nuclear program. Indian authorities have detained at least 1,500 people in India-administered Kashmir and razed the homes of suspected Kashmiri militants as fears mount over a larger conflict between India and Pakistan following the massacre last week of 26 people in the resort town of Pahalgam. India has accused the Pakistani government of backing the perpetrators of the massacre, but Islamabad has rejected any involvement. Soldiers from India and Pakistan have continued to exchange gunfire along the barrier separating Kashmir between the two nuclear-armed nations. The Sudan Doctors Network reports at least 31 people, including children, were executed by the paramilitary rapid support forces in Omdurman in what the group called a war crime and a crime against humanity. Omdurman is the sister city to the capital, Khartoum, which the Sudanese army reclaimed control over last month after 2 years of a devastating civil war. Separately, at least 11 people were killed in an RSF drone attack Friday at a displacement camp in River Nile State. Meanwhile, the UN reports at least 480 civilians were killed in Sudan's North Darfur over the two-week period starting April 10th, though the actual number is expected to be much higher. The UN also reports widespread sexual violence, including during the deadly attack on the Zamzam displacement camp between April 11th and 13th. Many rape victims are children. Numerous deaths have also been caused by hunger, shortages of water, or lack of medical care. The UN's described Sudan as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Protests continued Sunday in New York over a visit by Israel's far-right security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was once convicted for incitement to racism and support for a terrorist organization. On multiple occasions, supporters of Ben-Gvir attacked protesters and bystanders while chanting "Death to Arabs" in Hebrew. On Thursday, a mob of over 100 men surrounded and attacked a Brooklyn woman who lived nearby after they assumed she was a pro-Palestinian protester. In Los Angeles, student activists at Occidental College ended their hunger strike Friday after the school's administrators called the Los Angeles police and campus security to violently crack down on peaceful protesters outside the inauguration of Occidental President Tom Strittakis. Students had been demanding Occidental protect its students from immigration authorities and renounce any ties to Israel's war in Gaza. The hunger strikers say Occidental has agreed to certain measures supporting immigrant and international students. In a setback for press freedom, Attorney General Pam Bondi has rescinded a Biden-era policy that aimed to protect journalists in most cases from being forced to hand over their phone records in leak investigations. In a memo, Bondi described the conduct of government leakers as treasonous. In other media news, longtime 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley rebuked CBS's parent company Paramount at the end of Sunday night's broadcast of 60 Minutes. This came days after the show's top producer, Bill Owens, resigned, saying he no longer could make independent decisions about the show. This is a part of Scott Pelley's remarks.
Stories we pursued for 57 years are often controversial. Lately, the Israel-Gaza war and the Trump administration. Bill made sure they were accurate and fair. He was tough that way. But our parent company, Paramount, is trying to complete a merger. The Trump administration must approve it. Paramount began to supervise our content in new ways. None of our stories has been blocked, but Bill felt he lost the independence that honest journalism requires.
Expelled Republican Congress member George Santos was sentenced Friday to more than 7 years in prison for wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. The disgraced former New York Republican Congress member was ousted from the House in 2023 after less than a year in office. His brief political career was defined by numerous fabrications about his personal and professional life and campaign finance fraud. And Virginia Giuffre, an outspoken survivor of sex trafficking by Jeffrey Epstein, has died by suicide at age 41. She was the first survivor to come out publicly against Epstein, as well as his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell. She also sued Prince Andrew for sexually assaulting her when she was 17. The disgraced prince was forced to step away from his royal duties in Britain and settled with Giuffre in 2022. In a statement, Giuffre's family said, quote, Virginia was a fierce warrior in the fight against sexual abuse and sex trafficking. She was the light that lifted so many survivors, they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As President Trump marks 100 days since returning to office this week, protests have continued nationwide against his mass deportations and rising concerns of due process violations. On Friday, the Trump administration deported three U.S. citizen children to Honduras, including a four-year-old boy who was actively receiving treatment for a rare form of stage 4 cancer. The boy and his 7-year-old sister, who's also a U.S. citizen, were deported along with their undocumented mother. That same day, another child with U.S. citizenship, a 2-year-old girl, was also sent to Honduras with her mother, who's pregnant, and her undocumented 11-year-old sibling. In that case, U.S. District Judge Terry Doughty, who's a Trump appointee, said the girl was deported, quote, with no meaningful process, unquote. The judge added, quote, I've never seen anything like it. There is just no good faith interpretation for what happened to these children, the Trump-appointed judge said. The two mothers and their children were detained last week after attending routine check-ins with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Louisiana. Lawyers for both families say the mothers were coerced into taking their U.S. citizen children with them when they were deported. In the case of the 2-year-old girl, her father's still in the United States. A federal judge in Louisiana raised concerns about Trump officials removing her from the country against the wishes of her father. The mothers were reportedly prohibited from communicating with other family members or their lawyers after they were detained, and their relatives did not know of their whereabouts until the mothers arrived in Honduras. The cases have further raised questions of the harmful impacts of Trump's anti-immigrant policies will have on mixed-status families in the U.S. The Brookings Institution Center for Migration Studies estimates nearly 5 million U.S. citizen children have at least one undocumented parent. For more, we go to Gracie Willis, an attorney with the National Immigration Project representing the 2-year-old U.S. citizen girl who was deported from Louisiana early Friday morning. Gracie Willis, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you first describe what happened to your client? And then we'll go on to the 4-year-old boy suffering fourth stage cancer.
Yes, good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. What happened is that in the early morning hours on Friday, the United States government, after having detained U.S. citizen children, flew them out of the country with no eyes on these families. We have two families here, as you mentioned, and there are really striking similarities between these families and what they went through. In both, there were sort of two stories unfolding simultaneously. There was the outside and the inside. Outside, there were lawyers, loved ones, family members who were persistently trying to find these families and get contact with them. The asks were really simple. Where are they and can we speak with them? Inside, both of the mothers had the same request. Both of the mothers were trying to get in touch with anyone, a lawyer, family members, who could help them either figure out their immigration cases or help take care of their children. In both cases, ICE was speaking to both parties, telling the same lies that prevented communication between the mothers and the people who are trying to assist them outside. And this was to achieve ICE's ultimate aim, which was to send these parents and their children out of the country on a flight out of a rural airport under the cover of early morning hours without any access.
So I want to go to CBS's Face the Nation, where Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, claimed there were no due process violations when your client, a two-year-old U.S. citizen, was deported to Honduras with her mom.
I'm not aware of the specific case, but no U.S. citizen child was deported. Deported means you got to be reported by an immigration judge. We don't deport U.S. citizens.
The mother was These deported along were, with the were, children.
The children aren't deported. The mother chose to take the children with her. Now, when you enter the country illegally and you know you're here illegally and you choose to have your assistant child, that's on you. That's not on this administration. If you choose to put your family in that position, that's on them. But having a U.S. citizen child after you enter this country illegally is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It doesn't make you immune from our laws.
And this is the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, being questioned on NBC's Meet the Press, defending the Trump administration's decision to support U.S. citizen children. Deport.
If someone's in this country unlawfully, illegally, mm-hmm. that person gets deported. If that person is with a two-year-old child or has a two-year-old child and says, I want to take my child with me, well, then what? You have two choices. You can say, yes, of course you can take your child, whether they're a citizen or not, because it's your child. Or you can say, yes, you can go, but your child must stay behind. And then your headlines would read, U.S. holding hostage two-year-old, four-year-old, seven-year-old while mother deported. So the mother, the parents make that choice. I imagine those three U.S. citizen children have fathers here in the United States. Yeah. They can stay with their father. That's up to their family to decide where the children go. Children go with their parents. Parents decide where their children go. Right. The U.S. deported their mothers who were illegally in America.
So that's the U.S. Secretary of State, Gracie Willis. The parents get to decide, he said. Can you respond to both him and Tom Homan?
Absolutely. First of all, whether or not these were technically deportations is beside the point. The point is that these children were taken without any choice by their caregivers or them out of the country by ICE, which is an immigration agency. In terms of the parents' choice, Secretary Rubio's comments are incredibly misleading and disingenuous. At no point did these parents have any choice. They were not offered a choice. What do you want for your children? They weren't offered the kind of opportunity to speak with each other and make what would have been a very difficult decision, but one that two parents are entitled to make together about what's in the best interest of their family and what's in the best interest of their children. These mothers were told, your children will be deported with you. In our case, the government filed what was purported to be a handwritten note by our client's mother that said, I will bring my child with me. That's not a statement of wish. It's not a statement of desire, of choice. It's a statement that she was told, and she was told to write.
So at this point, what happens? I mean, it's very interesting that you have the judge, Judge Doughty, Trump appointed, who said there was no due process here.
At this point, the first thing that the families need to do is process what they've been through, the trauma they've been through, and attend to the safety and health of the family. There are safety and security concerns for some members of the family in Honduras, and so the families are making sure that they are somewhere safe. Secondly, attending to the health of the mother who's pregnant, who's in the early stages of a pregnancy, who's been through a significant trauma, ensuring that she and her unborn child are as well as possible, and attending to the health and well-being of the four-year-old who desperately needs medication and to continue treatment for his cancer.
Gracie, I want to ask you about this four-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. He's in fourth stage, rare form of cancer. He is in the midst of his treatment. He is deported out of the country without medication. Can you explain his case, though you are not officially representing this U.S. citizen?
That's correct. We're not attorneys on that case, but we're working closely with the attorneys representing that family. This family was brought into detention less than 24 hours before the plane took off in the mid-morning of on Thursday. And the attorney who's working with that family was actually with them at the ICE appointment where they were checking in. The kids were ready for school. They were expecting to go to school later that day. The family was taken into custody, asked for communication with their lawyer who was outside, and were denied that. That attorney filed what's called an administrative stay of removal, which is a request for ICE to just temporarily halt any deportation in the interest of something happening. And in this case, the lawyer requested the opportunity to file paperwork, complicated paperwork, with the court to provide immigration options to the mother, and especially to allow this four-year-old to continue treatment. The attorney filed paperwork with ICE explaining what this child's medical situation was, explaining the diagnosis, and didn't receive any kind of a response until the family was already on a plane on Friday morning.
And finally, it seems important to the Trump administration to keep maintaining that these kids, the child with four-stage rare cancer, the two-year-old, the seven-year-old, were not deported. They were simply attached to their mothers who were deported. Can you explain the difference between talking about deported and removed when we're talking about U.S. citizens?
Absolutely. We're in a situation with these two cases where we almost don't have the right word for it. ICE has the authority to deport people who are deportable, who are removable, whether that's because of finding of a judge or because somebody has accepted something called voluntary departure, anything that relates to somebody who's not a citizen of the United States and is either inadmissible to the United States or deportable from the United States. We don't really have great language around what it is to have an immigration agency send U.S. citizen people out of the country without any access to any way to contest that or express the option to stay in the United States.
Gracie Willis will closely follow these cases. Thanks so much for being with us from Austin, Texas, attorney with the National Immigration Project, representing the two-year-old U.S. citizen who was deported from Louisiana early Friday morning to Honduras. When we come back, the Trump administration escalates its attack on judges. On Friday, FBI agents arrested a Milwaukee judge. Stay with us.
Have forgiveness, Lord, now.
State Lines by Novo Amor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how the Trump administration is escalating its attacks on judges. On Friday, FBI agents arrested a county judge in Milwaukee, Judge Hannah Dugan, and charged her with obstructing justice and concealing an individual from arrest. The FBI accuses her of helping an undocumented immigrant leave her courtroom in her Wisconsin courthouse April 18th to avoid arrest by agents waiting in the hallway. That day, a Mexican immigrant named Eduardo Flores Ruiz was before her in a hearing on battery charges he faced stemming from an argument over loud music with his roommate, the roommate's girlfriend, and her cousin. Flores Ruiz had been working in the U.S. for about 12 years as a cook in Milwaukee after he was first deported in 2013. The day before the hearing, an immigration judge had issued a warrant for his arrest. After he left Judge Dugan's courtroom, agents reportedly saw Flores Ruiz walking down the hallway to the elevator and leave the courthouse. They arrested him minutes later outside. Judge Dugan's arrest just this past Friday came a week after all this unfolded, has drawn massive backlash across the country. Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin said, quote, this action fits into the deeply concerning pattern of this president's lawless behavior and undermining courts and Congress's checks on his power, unquote. FBI Director Kash Patel is facing accusations he broke DOJ policy by posting a photo online of Judge Dugan in handcuffs. On Saturday, protesters rallied outside the FBI building in St. Francis, Wisconsin, to protest the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants and the arrest of Judge Dugan.
And to do what she did, mm-hmm. and respect everything she tried to do. This, people think
People think we are not near fascism, but we are. They think it can't happen here, but it can and is happening here right now. And if we don't stop it before it gets too far along, we're going to be no better than Germany was in the 30s and 40s.
Wisconsin Judge Hannah Dugan was released Friday after her arrest by the FBI. On Sunday, reporters asked President Trump about the case.
What's next for cleaning up the courts after Judge Dugan's arrest?
Oh, it's terrible. What happened there is terrible. That that could happen with a judge is so a shame. And we have to... Look, we have to bring our country back from all these criminals that Biden allowed to come in. These are world-class criminals and people that are insane, people from jails, murderers, drug addicts, drug dealers. And, you know, we have a country. We have to be proud of our country. We can't let these people stay, and the courts are allowing them to stay. And we're not going to, we're just not going to allow it. So hopefully the Supreme Court will come to the rescue of our country.
For more, we're joined in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by Ann Jacobs, a Milwaukee-based attorney who personally knows Judge Hannah Dugan, has appeared before her in court. Jacobs is also chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Ann Jacobs, welcome to Democracy Now! What happened here?
It's a fascinating story, isn't it? And thank you for highlighting the fact that the director of the FBI made a photograph of Judge Dugan being taken away in handcuffs, which is just appalling and such an abuse of power. What happened here was, according to the complaint, immigration authorities, six people, two FBI, two ICE, a DE, and a couple of DEAs, I may have the numbers exactly wrong, but six people go to pick up this gentleman in court. Like courthouses across the country, we have metal detectors, so no guns allowed. And they come into the courthouse and they go to Judge Dugan's courtroom and they say, we're here to arrest this guy. And she says, we got a protocol. You have to go talk to the chief judge, whose courtroom is some distance away. And they say, fine. And she goes back in. The interesting part of all this is apparently four of the six go off to the chief judge's office, leaving the two DEA agents behind in the hallway. There's some lengthy discussion in the complaint about what happens in the courtroom, but I think it's undisputed, which is that she allows the public defender and the gentleman at issue to go out a side door. And from that side door, they exit onto the public hallway. In the public hallway are the two DEA agents sitting there, ostensibly waiting for him. The attorney and the gentleman come out into the hallway and they look around. This is in the complaint. They look around. Nothing happens to them. So they walk to the elevators and they go downstairs to leave the courthouse. The DEA agents, we don't know why, don't arrest him. One of them gets into the elevator with them and they go downstairs and then eventually he is arrested. That's the sum total of what really the accusations are against Judge Dugan. There's a lot of very breathless, she was stern, she walked quickly, she appeared angry. There's a lot of those sort of salacious tidbits. But in the end, the sum total of what she did is direct him to a side door and send him out to the public hallway.
To a public hallway where the agents yes. could have gotten him there. But she did express anger, right, to the agents before he appeared in court, that they were concerned that they would arrest him in her courtroom. Is that right?
That's certainly what the complaint says. And I want you to think about a couple of things. First of all, if you've ever met a judge, they're not always very happy when their courtroom is being disturbed. Secondly... And the assumption is that the only reason she's upset is that ICE is there to arrest him in her courtroom. In other words, that there's something about him that she is upset about. In her courtroom, she's in misdemeanor court. In her courtroom are witnesses, victims and the like, for whom an ICE going around, ICE agent going around arresting people can really impede the justice for those folks. So it's not only the fact that somebody who's charged with a crime is getting arrested, and I'm simply reading into the complaint, it is equally logical to be upset about the fact that they're coming into a courtroom where you need to have everyone in the community, documented or not, be able to feel safe.
I wanted to go to Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of the United States.
No one is above the law in this country. And if you are destroying evidence, if you are obstructing justice, when you have victims sitting in a courtroom of domestic violence and you're escorting a criminal defendant out a back door, it will not be tolerated, and it is a crime in the United States of America.
So that was U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi speaking on Fox News. And Jacobs, your response.
As lawyers, we have really strong ethical rules on what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say, in part to prevent impacting a court case, and especially for government attorneys who are required to be honest and accurate and everything else. And I think those sort of comments that she's making are unfortunate and designed to sort of taint the view of what happened here. It also makes it sound like this was going to be a trial and what have you. This was a pretrial hearing in misdemeanor court with an out-of-custody defendant. This is not some day of justice, as it were. It's a pretty ordinary day in a pretty ordinary court where you're going to have lots and lots of misdemeanants, persons charged with misdemeanors in the courtroom. And adjourning the case is not a denial of justice. It's a pretty ordinary thing. And she sent him out to a public corridor where law enforcement was waiting. And law enforcement looked at him and watched him walk to the elevators. It's just a bizarre story.
What message do you think the Trump administration is trying to send to judges as it loses one case after another, scores of cases around the country, whether we're talking about Trump-appointed judges, conservative judges, or not?
The message is crystal clear. If you cross the Trump administration, we will arrest you. I mean, I think that's literally what they are trying to do. So I think the goal is to chill judges from ruling against the Trump administration, requiring that they follow applicable laws and procedures when it comes to detentions, arrests, to require them to have valid warrants and the like. So certainly that's the intention of this, with the hopes that they can cudgel the judiciary into simply becoming meekly obedient to the executive branch.
Ann Jacobs, I want to thank you so much for being with us. An attorney based in Milwaukee knows Judge Hannah Dugan well, has appeared before her in court. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're staying in Milwaukee now, where on Friday, FBI agents arrested a Milwaukee County judge, Judge Hannah Dugan, after they accused her of obstructing justice and concealing an immigrant from arrest, when, in fact, the federal agents very soon after arrested the immigrant who had appeared in her court. We're speaking now with Emilio Dottore, the executive director of Milwaukee Turners, which was founded by immigrants and refugees in 1853. He's a longtime friend of Judge Dugan, spoke at both the Friday afternoon protest outside Milwaukee County Courthouse and at a Saturday protest in front of the FBI headquarters in St. Francis, Wisconsin, which was held to protest her arrest. Judge Dugan is a former board member of Milwaukee Turners. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Emilio. Start off by explaining what Milwaukee Turners is and your response to the judge's arrest.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Amy. The Milwaukee Turners is a 171-year-old civic society Founded, as you said, by immigrants and refugees. We operate out of an historic landmark in downtown Milwaukee, the longest continuously running gymnasiums there. We teach yoga, gymnastics, rock climbing, have trained Olympians there. There's a concert hall there. We do a variety of programs across two counties. In regards to the arrest, this is devastating. It's affecting folks all over, especially as it's rolled into the wake of the confusion of some almost 100 students in Wisconsin who faced a retraction of their F1 and J1 visas. This is just upsetting people all over the county.
You were one of the first people to protest her arrest, to get copies of the complaints against the judge and share them with the public. Can you talk more about what we know about her arrest and how this has affected the judge and the overall Milwaukee community and her long history in Milwaukee?
Sure. People were tremendously upset. I had folks calling early in the morning, alerting me to what had happened. As we shared copies of the complaints on Facebook, we had people reaching out who had gone to grade school with her, high school with her. She is a well-known and respected person, a former executive director of Catholic Charities, worked for Legal Aid, Legal Action, a former Milwaukee Bar Association president. She's not just some secluded figure in a courthouse. She is an active part of the community. She's known for giving out copies of the Constitution and flags on Constitution Day and Flag Day. This is somebody who is well-respected in multiple communities across the city, and this has a devastating effect on our social fabric, and also this sends a ripple of fear. This affiliate here, where I'm speaking to you from, is on MATC's campus, and with students being threatened in Marquette, at UWM, UW-Madison, MATC, Concordia, people with visas, people who may be undocumented, are now frightened to even come to the courts to pay municipal citations or to bear witness to a crime or to file for licensing. They don't understand what's going to happen if they feel as though a judge who is an integral part of the community can be picked up for what is seemingly nonsense, especially if it just appears to be a photo op to frighten other judges.
And can you respond to Kash Patel, to say the least, breaking with convention, ahead of the FBI, tweeting out, using words like perp walk and showing a picture of the judge in handcuffs and writing, "No one is above the law"?
It's absolutely disgusting and damaging. I think it sends an incorrect message to all of these armchair quarterbacks who are just going to believe a short character tweet. And locally, it has devastated many communities, not only just immigrant communities, but all folks who have known Judge Dugan for the decades of her selfless involvement here in the county. I personally find it disgusting that he would use such terminology for somebody so well-respected.
Do you think this has anything to do with the major Republican defeat over the special election for a judge where Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, spent I don't know how many millions on that race and even came out to Wisconsin and spoke and still lost? Do you think this is retribution for that?
I think it can surely be connected to that. I think it's a part of an attempt to stifle the judges, like Ann Jacobs said. It's an attempt to cudgel folks into submission. Hannah is known for elevating the rule of law and for honoring due process. And to make this statement against somebody who has been so admirable in her practice for so many years, it is ridiculous. And the fact that Kash Patel would add this terribly insulting photo and statements to it has actually had a reverse effect here in Milwaukee. I think people are more strongly supporting the judge, more strongly coming out on behalf of immigrants, and more strongly rejecting this message. And certainly you can connect it to the amount of money that they attempted to dump into the state Supreme Court race.
Mm. And finally, in related news, federal agents in New Mexico have arrested a former judge, Jose Luis Cano, and his wife. They've been accused of tampering with evidence linked to a former tenant who the government claims was a member of a Venezuelan gang. That was another judge, a former judge, who was arrested. The overall message being sent and what's happening on the ground now around organizing?
The overall message being sent is being linked to the same types of statements that that were made in 1930s Germany and 1940s Russia. Folks were actively comparing the recent federal statements from the United States to Stalin's statements about repressing the judiciary. I think these actions are just underscoring it. People here in Milwaukee are not taking kindly to the fact that our community, our economy, our family, now our courthouses and our schools are being disrupted by the heavy-handed overreach that we see. It really seems like an unjust and perhaps quite illegal grab into our courthouses. And it is having the opposite effect, I think, that the federal government had intended it to have.
Emilio Dottore is the executive director of Milwaukee Turners, longtime friend of Judge Hannah Dugan. When we come back, we speak with Martin O'Malley, former head of the Social Security Administration. He's issued a dire warning that Social Security could collapse due to sweeping Trump cuts. Stay with us. Heart of Darkness by Pere Ubu. The band's leader, David Thomas, died last week at the age of 71. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest, former Social Security Commissioner Martin O'Malley, is warning Social Security recipients could soon see their benefits interrupted or delayed. In a recent interview, O'Malley said moves by the Trump administration to cut costs at the Social Security Administration could, quote, crater the agency and lead to a system collapse. The Washington Post recently reported a flood of cuts pushed by the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, and Doge, are already leading the Social Security system to breaking down. The Post reports in March, Social Security website crashed four times in a 10-day span, blocking millions of retirees and disabled Americans from logging into their online accounts. Phone lines have also been overwhelmed due to staffing cuts. According to the group Social Security Works, around half of all seniors rely on Social Security for most of their income, while 25% of seniors rely on it for virtually all of their income. The average annual payout to these seniors is just $20,000 a year. Last month, Trump's Commerce Secretary, billionaire Howard Lutnick, sparked outrage after suggesting only fraudsters would complain if Social Security checks don't go out on time.
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She'd think something got messed up, and she'll get it next month. A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Trump advisor Elon Musk recently described Social Security as a Ponzi scheme during an interview with Joe Rogan.
Well, I mean, the government's one big pyramid scheme, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, you can tell me better than anybody.
Social Security is the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Elon Musk's attacks on Social Security come as the Trump administration's moving to cut off benefits to more than 6,000 immigrants who'd lawfully obtained Social Security numbers were paying into the system for years. The administration's doing this by falsely labeling them as dead to cut off their benefits. We're joined now by Martin O'Malley, who served as Social Security Commissioner under President Biden. He's also the former governor of Maryland and the former mayor of Baltimore. It's great to have you with us, Governor O'Malley. Commissioner O'Malley, if you can start off by explaining why you say that you think the Social Security system in this country is on the brink.
Well, because of all of the things that Elon Musk and the Doge team and Donald Trump have been doing to Social Security with a speed and a virulence that I think is stunning, shocking. I mean, they have, Amy, actually been paying people with our money at an agency that was already at a 50-year low of staffing and all-time high beneficiary customers. They've been paying them to leave. They have created a hostile work environment. They have engaged in wholesale, like firing and entire offices and divisions. They have driven out almost by now 10,000 people out of the agency. They say 7,000, it's going to go down to 10,000. And part of that is a 50% reduction in the people that keep the IT systems going. The same IT systems that never missed a beat and sent out the checks, the right amount to the right person at the right time every month, all through COVID. They have cut the IT department in half. You're seeing, as you just mentioned, outages in some of the customer-facing aspects of it. Those outages are going to become more regular rather than intermittent. They're going to happen for longer durations. And ultimately, you're going to see that cascade into a collapse of the entire system and an interruption for some time of benefits. I don't see what the path that they're on. I believe they've taken probably 90% of the actions necessary to accomplish that aim.
So can you explain this master death list and putting 6,000 people who've paid into Social Security on the list that says they are dead? We're talking about immigrants and where this master list goes?
Sure. That's an operational question rather than a question about what their intent is. I mean, this is some really chilling stuff. By law, Congress requires the Social Security Administration, which maintains a lot of personal data on all of us from our first summer job, from the first moment we're born, actually. Social Security is required to keep what Congress has dubbed the master death file. And so Social Security has contracts with all 50 states, the territories, and the second that a death certificate is recorded, Social Security lists that in the master death file, and then a lot of other entities ping off of that. In other words, our banking systems, credit companies, the IRS. And so if you list somebody as deceased, when clearly they're not deceased, it has the effect, as their puppet acting commissioner of Social Security said, it has the effect of terminating the financial lives of people here in the United States. It is a stunning, willful criminal act, any one of those counts, to put a false information into a federal record, and in particular, a Social Security record. And yet they're doing it with a breadth, in total violation, a breadth and a scope and a depth way beyond anything that's happened before, and actually in direct contravention and direct exactly opposite of what a federal judge ordered them to do, which was stay the hell out of our personal data.
Now, you have at the same time that all of this is happening, the degrading of the system, President Trump insisting that he's not planning to cut Social Security. But can you talk about what you see as Trump and Musk's ultimate vision for Social Security? Do they just want to make it unworkable so that it's privatized? And in this, talk about the history of Social Security. How many people get it, Social Security and disability benefits as well?
Sure. For 90 years, Social Security has never, ever missed a monthly payment. And right now, there are approximately 73 million Americans who are in pay status, who are beneficiaries, whether in the survivor and old age aspect and widows and orphans, or whether it's people with disabilities who can no longer work. Now, the question you ask, Amy, about what their ultimate goal is hard to figure. Social Security, as you probably know, and many of your viewers know, is not a Ponzi scheme. It is a pay-as-you-go program. Americans working this year pay in $1.3 trillion, and Social Security pays out those same dollars to beneficiaries. And when, as now, with baby boomers moving through the system, Social Security makes up any difference from its large surplus reserve. And many people believe it is that large surplus reserve, the only agency that runs a large surplus reserve of $2.6 trillion that Donald Trump and Elon Musk have their eyes on. I don't know what they want to do with that money, but it does appear that they're trying to precipitate an emergency situation, knowing that Congress would never allow them to touch it absent an emergency. I do believe that they're trying to wreck Social Security's reputation, wreck its ability to serve its customers, wreck its unbeaten string of regular monthly payments, so that having wrecked it, then they have an emergency under which they can rob it.
So if you can talk about what has happened when it comes to, first, they said they're going to cut off the phone ability to call a helpline, which for so many Social Security recipients is the only way they could communicate with Social Security. That would force them to satellite offices, of which they closed many. What is happening right now, and what do you say has to happen to fix this system at this point?
Well, it is going to take years now to build back Social Security. You know, last year, the men and women of the Social Security Administration achieved some of the best customer service timeliness achievements in certainly since before COVID. Some of them, you know, the best timeliness in 10 years. For example, answering that phone used to be an average wait. 42 and a half minutes. They got that down to just over 12 minutes. But now all of those things are going in the wrong direction. Social Security is one of the most trusted brands in the entire federal government, second only to the National Park Service and Smokey the Bear. So what they have to do in order to get away with whatever their end goal is on, you know, with their eyes on that big trust fund, they have to degrade its ability to serve customers. They have to turn people away from it or against it. You've heard a lot of big lies about Social Security. You've heard Elon Musk say it's a Ponzi scheme, just like the rest of our government. Illegal immigrants get Social Security benefits when they don't. You've heard about the zombie apocalypse. That is, you know, millions of people roaming the earth and taking our money. None of those things is true. But the other big lie you hear, Amy, is that Social Security is bad. It's always been bad. It's never really worked. So that's the big lie they're pushing. And then they demonstrate it by cramming as many people into Social Security offices as they can for services that they used to be able to get online or used to be able to get on the phone. And that's going to be the evidence then that they create that it's always been bad. So, you know, we had to privatize it or we had to liquidate it. Here's your lump sum. Be happy. Go away. It was always a Democratic program that never worked. So that's what's going on here. And it's happening with a stunning speed that I think is Americans are waking up to.
And in the 10 seconds that we have left, this allegation that, you know, immigrants are being fraudulent in getting Social Security, they have paid into the system for years. It's their money.
Well, actually, illegal immigrants, so-called people working here outside of legal status, cannot receive any Social Security benefits and never have been able to. They're prohibited by law. But they do pay in $25 billion for the benefit of the rest of us and into the Social Security Trust Fund. It's a total lie. Illegal immigrants do not receive Social Security benefits.
And yet they pay. Martin O'Malley, thank you so much for being with us, former Social Security Administrator.